came a day. Well, he died last night, boy. Oh, Lord, with a bullet in his head. Well, I saw those little king when he went to motel trying to take some rest. That mean old snobber shot him dead to the neck. That Dr. Luther King was dead. Pink cotton, fly down planting jets all over my head. I went to the graveyard. I peeped down Dr. Luther King face. I said, sleep on Dr. Luther King. We're marching on me right today. You, Dr. Luther King, there. Yeah, where I go, boy. Flying airplane jets all over my head. Sad word to say, great man. Reach the
eye. So, if you're outside of our coverage area, remember, you can listen to WRCT online. Live streaming available at www.wrct.org. WRCT Pittsburgh. You have no excuse not to listen.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Welcome to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm Richard Gordon, and she's...
Riona Duncan.
And we're here with two fine professors of our acquaintance to talk about some translation issues.
We have Christopher Jones, who's Professor Emeritus of French and Francophone Studies at Carnegie Mellon. Hello.
Hello. Good to be here.
So glad to have you here. And we also have Marcy Forsine, who's Assistant Professor and Director of Undergraduate Studies in Classics down at Pitt.
Hi. Happy to be here.
Thank you so much.
I just got to start by saying I knew that Christopher had been all over the place and learning all sorts of different languages. But I was amazed when I just learned that he got to Portugal to play pro basketball, and he had one word in Portuguese.
That's correct. And it was an eye-opener going to Portugal after having been a very poor student of German, and I still have no German, but being dropped into a bath of a foreign language and at a time when there were very few English speakers in Portugal. So it was sink or swim, so to speak, and I swam.
As hard as it is for us to understand each other when we speak the same language, what the heck happens once you start adding different languages?
Increased difficulty, I think, but also increased opportunity for communication to happen, right? So there's some places where languages can meet the needs that another language doesn't realize it has. So, for example, you might think of how in Japanese there's a particular word for someone who is an upperclassman who might be a mentor figure for you, a senpai.
We don't have an equivalent like that in English, which can make things kind of difficult, like when you're trying to refer to someone who is a third-year graduate student and you're a mere first-year graduate student and utterly lost in the sauce. It can be nice to be able to refer to someone who has advanced experience than you, but English doesn't have any such word.
Wait, wait, you're a classics professor and you're telling us about words in modern Japanese?
Well, that's not, I don't know very much Japanese. Maybe someday, though.
It is true that many languages have these levels. In Japanese, it's honorifics, but in Chinese and in Latin languages, there's familiar and formal ways of address, which for Americans can be somewhat problematic. But we do eventually adapt if we're planning to integrate ourselves into the culture.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it can lead to interesting problems and opportunities, even in classics. So I remember going to a lecture some years ago by Professor Jinyu Liu, who was in the middle of translating some of Ovid's love letters into Japanese. And in Latin, it is very rare to use personal pronouns because it's an inflected language. So the verbs contain the concept of who is doing an action. So you don't need to use to very often or vos very often. It's implied in the verb. But the very first word, when you translate into Japanese, a love poem that begins with "you are so beautiful" needs to be one of these levels of familiarity. Is it anata? Is it anta? Or is it something more formal than that? And I remember just being blown away by her lecture on this.
Going back to Americans learning other languages, do you think Americans are worse than other cultures at learning language? Because I've heard that from various people.
You often hear it from Americans themselves, right? Oh, I'm bad at languages and so forth, not naming any names. I think learning languages there is an aptitude. I don't think there's any research that shows that any particular cultural group is better or worse than another at learning languages. But then you get around to need. If you need to learn a language, myself arriving in Portugal and being interviewed by a journalist needing someone to interpret, then going into a small town where there was an American pastor who spoke English and that was it. The need, and I got it by then also, but how many Americans in their kind of daily life need to learn another language? Some, you know, if you're working in the medical fields, even sometimes in law and places like that, where at least you might need a decent knowledge of Spanish. In the courts, you somehow need to be able to communicate in English what a witness may have only been able to express in Ukrainian or something like that. I mean, that's, so there is need there, but it's not a large need among Americans generally. And without getting into the fact that the world speaks English now, that makes us worse students of language.
One of the things that I think affects it is fear of failure. I didn't take French or Italian or Spanish or German. I stuck with Latin, which was taught to me as a dead language. Sorry.
Yeah, but, no,
but it was a fear of failure. I didn't want to do this. And when my son and I took a trip to Germany, I got along with the shopkeepers better than he did, even though he was studying German, because he was too scared to make a mistake.
Right, absolutely. When, this is an anecdote, but when I was in college, I was fortunate enough to live with two of my best friends, who I'm still very good friends with. And one of them, her primary language was Spanish, and she spoke Spanish with her family. And my other friend's primary language was Taiwanese. And I remember moving in with them and saying, hey, wouldn't it be great if I could improve my Spanish with you and start to learn Cantonese with you? And then both of them, as one, basically turned to me and said, it would be too much work. We want to actually be your friend, not your teachers. Right? So there's this space for failure. There's
you know, the question of how you can immerse yourself. There's the urgency, the need to learn. And then there's also this ease of communication by having what's often referred to as a lingua franca, right, which English serves as a lingua franca in the U.S. And so some people might accuse Americans of being lazy by defaulting to English, but actually a lot of times it allows us to cut through these difficulties of, oh, that's not the word that you mean. I'm not looking for that word. I'm not going to correct your grammar. We're going to have the conversation instead. But it is a lost opportunity as well. And at the end of 2 years of living with these two folks, my friend who was trying desperately not to teach me Cantonese finally capitulated enough to teach me how to say "wobu dojowe," which means I don't speak Mandarin.
Je m'appelle Richard, je ne comprends pas français, you know?
Je parle un peu de français. Mais c'est terrible.
Another difficulty, I think, in translation is when it gets beyond even just the literal, like, what word do you get to correct, and gets more into translating poetry. Mm-hmm. How have you guys experienced that?
Translation of works of art, whether it's poetry, fiction, and then, of course, there are other areas of translation like law, contract law, for example. I've had an experience with that. But poetry, song, fiction, we really have all these, not just linguistic elements, but cultural elements. So word-to-word translations are often ridiculous, and really do not carry the meaning in any significant way. And a couple of examples that occurred to me, I don't know whether you've ever read Montalbano, the Inspector Montalbano, who is a Sicilian, written by a guy named Camilleri, who writes in this extremely idiosyncratic Sicilian dialect. Where do you start? I'm a translator. I speak perfectly adequate English, and it's Midwestern English, which is to say Tom Brokaw's English, i.e. the standard English, if there is such a thing in the U.S. And I'm going to translate this Sicilian writer who writes in a Sicilian dialect, which is strange even to Italians. Where do you start? First of all, there's all the aspects of the culture itself, everything from dress, interaction between the sexes, food, daily life, and all that other kind of stuff. But then you have to somehow get across to an English speaker this dialect, which is non-standard. Now, he has been translated into like a Jersey dialect, you know, some sort of really heavy New York area dialect, you know, with all this kind of weird expressions and so forth, which is a legitimate effort,
right,
to take that across. Mm-hmm. Now, poetry is a whole different story, and song, which is, of course, my principal area of expression these days. For example, I just did, which Richard has, a CD in French, working with a poet from Montreal. And I did translations of his texts. I wrote some myself in French. And we just gave a presentation up in Quebec City on this. And what it meant and what my translations were. And my translations were de sens, of the sense. Mm-hmm. It was not possible without another year to attempt to write his texts into an English song with the same music and so forth. And that's almost never done because of the level of difficulty,
right,
both cultural and the additional complication of music, and then, the demands of rhyme and colloquial expression and all those sorts of things, really complicated, terribly.
I think I've seen the closest I've seen to that is, you know, besides your record, Montreal Encore, is if you go to the opera and there are super titles in your language while they're singing in the original language, or if they're singing in whatever the language is of the audience as opposed to the original that it was written in.
Right. And thinking about your experience with music, Christopher, it reminded me of Louis Armstrong's translation of Jean Rose, which is dissonance, right? It's not word for word. And when you try to translate music sensibly, you have the understructure of the music itself, right? So you get the jazz undertones. You know that it's a love song when you start listening to it, whether it's Louis singing it or Edith Piaf. And turning to Riona's question to think about poetry can be very difficult, as you highlighted, Christopher, but we do have, just like in music, the song that supports it, the melody, the instrumentation. In poetry, you have the meter, the rhyme scheme, the vocabulary decisions. And, you know, in classics, one of the places where this becomes fun and interesting and difficult and problematic is the age of the text that you're looking at, because so many people want or expect to open a translation of, say, the Aeneid or the Iliad and be met with something that sounds like Shakespeare to them, something that is archaic and grand and maybe bombastic. Virgil's Latin is fairly bombastic, but Homer's Greek is very readable, and it paces very quickly, and it has this beautiful flow to it, which is so difficult to put into English meter in a way that doesn't sound heavy or difficult. And we have all of these names to wrestle with, and all of these epithets and formulae that feel very alien to American poetic forms, right? So why is he always swift-footed Achilles or horse-tail-helmeted Hector, which all of those things just feel very burdensome to us, whereas we would just say Hector came on, and we would have other alliterations and descriptions.
Marcy, one of the things that Riona told me about you that I just am fascinated about is that one of your areas especially is that period of time when Latin and Greek coexisted at the top of the European pyramid.
Yes, yes. So my area of specialty is Roman satire, especially early Roman satire. So Riona and I got to talking in the course of this Latin class that we engaged in, which was an epic Latin class, but an epic Latin class not on the Aeneid, but on its predecessor, which is a fragmentary text called the Annales. And we were looking at this time period in Roman history, which is roughly the end of the 3rd century BCE into the 2nd century BCE, when Rome starts to become an empire, even as it remains governmentally a republic. But one of the first places that Rome colonizes is Greece, just across the Tyrrhenian. And what's so interesting about this is that in many ways, the Italian peninsula had already been Greek, right? So Naples, for example, was a Greek colony. And Ischia, as we know it now, was already a Greek colony. So Naples is Neapolis in Greek, or the new city. So even before Rome formally triumphs over Macedon and takes over the Greek mainland, the people who speak Latin are side by side, neighbors, poets in common, philosophers in common with people who speak Greek. And these languages are so closely related to one another, but to come back full circle, they're also not quite fully mutually intelligible. They use different scripts, they have different vocabulary. It's not different from, say, a Spanish speaker who goes to Portugal and can understand maybe 60 to 70% of what's going on, but is still missing nuances and still struggles to get the pronunciation right, etc. So it's a fun period of time because there's so much happening politically in the space, and there are all of these ways in which the Romans are trying to navigate this new prestige that they have over these neighbors that previously had dominated the Mediterranean. So they're grappling with this newfound power, whereas the Greeks are on the opposite side of things. They're trying to understand how they've lost these wars, who these neighbors are they actually Greeks after all? They speak a very similar language to us. And this is something that Dionysius of Halicarnassus, for example, says, oh, it's okay that we were conquered by the Romans. The Romans are actually Greeks.
I don't think of Greek and Latin or Greek and Italian as similar.
Greek and Italian are pretty distant, especially modern Greek and modern Italian.
Okay.
So the linguistic journeys of those two languages through phonetic vowel shifts in particular have made them incredibly distinct languages in the contemporary world. But if you were to map out the Indo-European family tree, for example, you would put Greek and Latin as close branches on the same bough.
Would you say that, you know, the Latins are Greek because they speak a similar language, for example, if you know you got to make yourself feel better? Would you say that the different languages also lead to, like, maybe similar forms of thinking or forms of doing things culturally?
This is interesting. So this is an argument that I think Noam Chomsky iterates in one of his very, very many works. And it, you know, again, kind of comes back to what we were discussing earlier about how some languages seem to fill gaps that others don't necessarily know that they have. To me, it seems that we have sort of a Gordian knot of which comes first, right? Does language form the way that we think, or does the way that we think form language? And it's a very difficult and very slippery slope, because if we start to think of language determinism, then that can be utilized to argument for certain hierarchy of languages, which are false, I think. I think that every language offers something unique, and I think languages are born and utilized within social contexts that shift over time, right? So I think for the Greeks who are saying, hey, Latin is so similar to our language, it's basically like we were conquered by our cousins, so it's not a big deal. They're utilizing language politically, but they're also doing that purposefully rather than saying, oh, you know, because we speak the same language or we speak sibling languages or cousin languages, it's inevitable that we would be a part of the same empire, right? Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so.
Christopher, please chime in.
So, yeah, the notion that language determines what we're able to think is what really interests me. And I brought in this book called Language, Thought, and Reality by Benjamin Lee Whorf, who makes this thesis explicitly using the Hopi language and so forth. When I was reading this, I was living in Lisbon. I had near native fluency in Portuguese, a good start on French and Spanish, and I thought, okay, I sort of get this. Now, I'm not feeling that difference in a restriction in the way I would think in either in any of those languages. So let me try something else. The time I had a visit from someone who was very politically involved, I was choosing between Chinese and Japanese. Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, you can't learn Japanese, those capitalists, you know. Mm-hmm. And of course, I went and then studied Chinese at the University of Paris, where there were 1,000 first-year students of Chinese who were all there because they wanted to be Red Guards.
Mm, right.
They wanted to. They were Maoists.
The Cultural Revolution.
They were Maoists during the Cultural Revolution. This was back a ways. Well, it worked for me. One of his Whorf's primary theses is that languages divide space in time. I mean, these are basic concepts, right? Mm-hmm. Well, the Latin-based languages have quite a sophisticated way of saying, well, yes, 2 years ago, but before then, and before then, and even before then, and then after that before type of thing, which is, we take it for granted, you know. Even in English, even though we don't have the formal conjugations that the Latin-based languages do. But in Chinese, there are essentially three
adverbial time markers.
Yeah, exactly. You can say, okay, it's happening, it stopped happening, or it will happen. That's it. At one point, I tried to actually interpret in this school that I was in, the National Institute for Oriental Languages, they have an interpreting sort of program. And I did some kind of self-testing of interpreting between English and French. It was possible. I mean, it's extraordinarily stressful in terms of your cognitive machine. But when I tried to translate from Chinese to French, I immediately got this massive migraine. It was just not. People do it in diplomatic circles. They're mostly Chinese. It's very rare to have American interpreters be able to make that leap and frame a Chinese expression of time, space, and all the other content that's going into the message, make that back and forth. Anyway, this was, for me, this was a kind of a seminal moment, the notion that, you know, what I might think I was clever, but I could only be as clever as the languages I knew. I couldn't be Chinese clever, really. Mm-hmm. I couldn't be Hopi clever, and so forth. And anyway, this is, you know, what does it mean to use a certain language to think, much less write or translate, you know? So.
Do you sometimes find that there are some ideas you can only think of in one of the languages you know? They don't work in another language?
I think that's true, although the languages in which I'm really fluent, I mean, I finished a degree in Chinese, but that was, it's not fresh anymore. 还可以说一点儿,但是我的中文不错了。So I
have good
accent. We'll
have to include subtitles.
No, I think to your point, to one of your many points here, there are always things that are difficult to capture fully from one language to another. But I guess I have the follow-up question. When these difficulties occur in translations, I have to ask myself sometimes if I'm struggling with grammar and syntax, right? The framing of the language itself, which to your point about Mandarin and Cantonese with these time markers versus tenses, which inflected languages in European descent have different tenses and aspects structured built into the languages. Yeah. Or if it is to Worf's point, a system of thought that is reflected as different. And to me, I love this title of the book. I'm looking at it right now, and it's Language, Thought, and Reality, because to me, language is one way in which we approach reality, right? And so we might have a language that doesn't allow us to express temporality beyond just now, and soon to come. But we still live in the same time-space continuum as people who have inflected languages that have, I used to be able to do this, I was starting to do this, I will in the future have done this, right? Which is something that is much more Latinate or Greek or Germanic. And to me, the fact that we live in a world where we're constantly, even in spaces that seem to be carved out as more monolingual, to me, we are still exposed to people who are speaking different languages and utilizing time in different ways. So I wonder, I don't like to think of this as restrictive. I like to think of these languages as being mutually buoying one another up, if that makes sense, right? The opportunities that you have to express time in Mandarin contrasted with the opportunities you have to express time in German compared to what you can do with Icelandic, right? They're each different and complementary. But maybe that also means that there are limiting factors. Maybe you don't get one without the other.
Yeah, I think that's right. But your basic point that this is not a limitation but rather an expansion, I totally accept that. In other words, what it brought me to study Chinese and to learn Latin languages and so forth was not a limitation. I mean, it broke me out of my mold.
Yes.
In a very important way. And in these ways, but in cultural ways and sort of ways of being, seeing, interacting.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And something that Rione's heard me talk about in class before is that often the best way that you learn your primary language is by learning a secondary language. You don't realize that you didn't have a word for something until you learn that word in another language.
Or in my case, I really, really had to learn my English grammar while I was teaching English as a second language.
Yes.
To students whose TOEFL scores were too low to be admitted to the University of Missouri, and they had to pass my course.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. You have to think about why to use that versus which in certain scenarios. And why would you use quad in a certain place but not in another place? And why would you use the subjunctive here but not there? Sorry to get into the Latin jargon of it all.
I once had a Mexican student tell me, "Mr. Richard, your language is so impoverished without subjunctive."
Yes, they were absolutely right. But it's so interesting because this concept of language poverty actually goes back to the ancient world. Because I promise that I won't always reset us to the year 100. But,
please do, honestly.
But we have as early as Lucretius, who writes a poem, an epic poem about Epicurean philosophy and how everything is doomed to decay and destruction. That's a great poem. Very exciting read. He opens up by saying, "I'm translating Greek philosophy into Latin, and it's so difficult because of the egestos of Latin." And the egestos means essentially the beggarliness, the absolute grasping need that this language has. And it's true that if I were to pull out a Latin dictionary versus a Greek dictionary, the ancient Greek dictionary would easily be at least 3 times the size of the Latin dictionary. It is by far and away a much shorter vocabulary. And so as far back as Lucretius, we have someone saying, "Oh, your language is terrible." But in his case, he says, "My language is terrible. I need to use Greek," which is fascinating because then he doesn't use his Latin instead.
Our conversation with Christopher Mark Jones, an emeritus professor of French and Francophone Studies from CMU, and Marcy Persine, an assistant professor of Classics at the University of Pittsburgh, was so intriguing that Riona, Duncan, and I decided to split it in two. Tune in again for Forbes Avenue to hear part two of our discussion about translation and language.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Possibility of lung cancer can be pretty scary, especially if you're one of approximately 8 million current or former smokers at high risk. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know that now there's a breakthrough low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early, and it only takes 60 seconds. You stop smoking, now start screening. For an easy quiz to see if you're eligible, visit SaveByTheScan.org. It could save your life. SaveByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
RCT Pittsburgh, WRCT.org. Welcome to Ebony Spectrum. Let's take a listen to Karen Hunter and others.
There's a lady named Ellie Way. She's unmelanated. She tweeted, "I don't know if Ryan Coogler intended this, though I feel that he must have on some level." Did you see this tweet?
Right before we came away.
Okay. "But Sinners left me with a real sense of grief over the disconnect I feel from my cultural heritage. I'm a white American, and I have no idea where I came from. I have no cultural roots to draw from. My past is just empty."
Did you see the somebody? Reply?
Yeah, somebody said, "So you ain't see the Klan in the movie?" But see, you know what,
that's cold, man.
So I felt her because yesterday I had a caller because I asked for it. I asked for somebody to call up, and he still didn't answer my question. But I'm challenging people who identify with this made up construct of whiteness,
right?
To do exactly what she's doing. Yeah, ask yourself why.
Yeah.
Are you Irish? Are you Italian?
It was cold that they picked her when she was down like that. That's all.
Yeah.
Like, it's funny, but it's kind of cold. Y'all ain't had to do her. Like, y'all knew what she was trying to say.
But I'm saying, why identify with the Klan? And I'm glad that Ellie didn't identify with the Klan.
Yeah, of course.
She's like, that ain't me. Them ain't my people. I'm not identifying with that. And I'm saying, in this era where everybody's trying to remove books and stuff, well, not everybody, Trump and his people and the daughters of Knuckle Dragon Liberty and all of the stuff, trying to remove books because it makes their children feel bad. Why do you raise your children to identify with the Klan, with the with the colonizers, with the rapists, with the genociders? Why not?
Right.
Why not tell them the difference?
Yeah. My question for her is twofold. There's 2 points. The first point is, I actually love that Ryan Coogler didn't put the cool white people in it. I'm not saying that I like movies that do that. There's a time and place for that. I like that this wasn't about that. It wasn't like, and here's the white people on the Underground Railroad. It was like, no, that they weren't part of this story. But the second thing is, it's interesting she chose to say she couldn't relate, because the characteristics in those characters are universal characteristics. They are not black only characteristics. Bravery is a universal characteristic. Spirituality is a universal characteristic, right? Like, you don't have to, I don't know nothing about hoodoo, but I was looking at one, being like, oh my God, you know, I feel that. That's my auntie, you know? And so you don't have to be black to understand. Even when you talk about moonshine or being a gangster, that's not a black only thing. Music is not black only, like, as evidenced by them doing that damn jig. Like, it's not. So that's stuff to identify with. You don't have to come at it from a cultural racial angle. You won't identify with it the same as a black American, but honestly, it's about damn time we had some. So let us have this one, and you can go watch any Wes Anderson film you want and you'll get the vibes.
Right That part. But, you know, it is sad because whiteness is a made up construct that is it forces people into a criminal enterprise and forces them to defend it. Right. If you want to be a part of it. And that's a hell of a thing for the majority of people in this country to have to align themselves with the Trail of Tears and enslavement and all. Like, why should they have to fly a Confederate flag? When you look at a Trump rally and you see a Confederate flag, like, you fought the, you what, 90% of the people out there that lost their lives during the Civil War fighting for enslavement didn't own anybody.
Didn't own slaves.
So they're fighting. So you're telling me you and your people fighting to want to own somebody? Like, is this who you are? Like, at some point, there's got to be a reckoning on this narrative, and you're fighting to preserve your whiteness when DNA-wise, ask the South Africans.
Yes.
There's a Skin. I talk about this movie, Skin. Sophie Okonedo plays a girl born into a white family, but she turned out looking like you. Because the DNA, I learned that in biology, 10th grade.
Right.
Recessive versus dominant, which is why this whole notion of an Aryan master race makes no biological sense. And every scientist that's out there talking about it, your DNA will always fight you.
Right.
Silly rabbits.
Might as well be talking about phrenology or whatever. But it's so interesting because the limits of her imagination. Because her mind is trapped in whiteness. So she's like, I can't identify with this. And the reason I pointed out this specific way is because as black people, all of us understand. We've all had to watch stories we weren't part of and we identified. Every single one of us. We watched a story that didn't have a place where they put black people in it. And we walked out of there and we still found ourselves.
Hold on, Rod. I got to get off. I just got a DM. I'm sorry. Let's go to line 7. No. Come on through, Cornbread. Omar Miller in Los Angeles is on the line. You better stop playing with me, sir.
What's happening?
What's up? Hello.
Oh, you know.
I may never be a filmmaker, but he inspires me to be even better at the thing.
How are things?
Listen. I'm sorry you got like that, but you went too far to the bathroom. Why you ain't just go around to the... How you... Go all the way.
No answer. If you go outside the juke, they got you either way it goes.
Yeah, well, that's true. That's true. But then you ain't had to come back and get the people like that. Talk about, can we just all get along? I said, man, why are you trying to get the people got?
How many takes did they give people. You?
That's why.
How many takes did they give you? Did you improv any of that, like getting back in and stuff? Because that seemed real fun.
Oh, it was a lot of fun. And it was, and I improvised a lot of it. But Ryan's writing is so solid that he had the essence of what we were trying to do. So I just stayed within that with the improv. But if you look at it from a symbolic and a metaphoric standpoint, Delroy, I did a lot of my presses go around with Delroy Lindo, the Fabulous Thespian. Mm. And he described the film in this great way, of that it's a film about a vibrant community that gets infiltrated by outsiders and then turns on itself. And you see what it is. And like, my character is a catalyst, because once he comes back and he's trying to get in, from that point forward, you are on the full speed roller coaster.
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
It really picks up from that point. You see it from a metaphoric standpoint. The character is trying to get back in to do to his own people what has been done to him, which is so deep.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Omar, can you listen? First of all, how'd you end up here? You driving around? And you just said, I'm going to call in to the Carol at the show. What did somebody tell you you got to call in? What happened?
No, not at all. I listen to your show all the time. I've been listening to your show for a long time.
Miller's listening. This is so, I'm so humbled right now. First of all, I fell in love with you on Ballers, right? Ballers?
Mm-hmm.
You were my dude. Okay.
Thank you.
And
to
see you in this role, I mean, I just absolutely love your humanity. It just shows, it comes through in everything that you do. And even this, I didn't want Cornbread to get got like that. Your
me
wife
neither,
right
man.
Now, I said, oh, no.
Why
nah,
I had to be
a,
Cornbread?
Not Cornbread. Then you, oh, my goodness. All right, so I'm going to need you to hold on, because I have a 11 billion questions for you. So Rod and I are just here giving out tickets, you know, to Sinners and chopping it up with the people. And then on line 7, there's a guy named Omar and Callie. And then the screener said, it's Omar from Sinners, Cornbread. I was like, no way. And it's him. So
crazy.
Omar's sticking around. Omar Benson Miller. Shout out to his brother, Terry, who's also listening. How did you get the role? And how many people did you have to audition? And were you up against a bunch of folk for this role? Because it's pivotal.
It's pivotal. And you know what's funny is that I actually met Coogler years ago, probably like 15, 16 years ago, at the Miracle of St. Anna. I was getting an award, a Rising Star Award, at the Pan-African Film Festival, and he was still in college. And he was interning at the award show, and he came up to me afterwards. I was with my brother, with my mom, with my family, and he said, man, I love your stuff. I'm going to work with you one day. And as I'm apt to do, I was like, yeah, brother, I'll see you there. And little did I know, he was about to turn into Ryan Coogler. And, you know, he clearly turned it up between Fruitvale and Creed and Panther, and I got a call that he wanted to meet up, and so I said okay, and I walked in. He sent some materials. Everything was super high classified, you know, they kept it all under wraps. So he sent some material, and I came in, and the first thing he did was apologize that I didn't have any audition. And I was like, man, this dude is as humble as they come. That's part of the job, you know. Sometimes I audition, sometimes I don't. That's, you know, that it is what it is. That's how the game works. But I'm capable of auditioning. And so we had the audition process in the room. He was like, oh, yeah, it's exactly how I knew it was going to be. Which, you know, kind of indicated to me that there was maybe somebody else who had questions about whether or not I was the right person. And next thing I know, about 2-3 weeks later, I was on a plane to New Orleans to make the film. And man, oh, man, has he become a part of my life, man. That brother, to use the vernacular, protect Ryan Coogler at all costs. He's a very righteous, solid young man.
Yes.
Are you going to finesse your way into Black Panther 3?
That's up to him. Like, there's no finesse. Okay. I'm not even trying to be shy. If Ryan calls, then we on set. Count on him.
You should like, was you trying to like sneak in an African accent on set just to show him like you could do it?
The Black Panther is stripped.
Where is the craft services table?
Oh.
No, I don't know. The power of the Blick is, you know, that's my man. That's my man, Forrest Whitaker. That's already there. And everybody always getting us confused anyway. So I try to tread lightly.
He could be
you can
son.
Play his son.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Black Panther 3.
We got a role. Okay.
Y'all done already cast the movie.
Omar Benson Miller, when did you know? Because I'll be honest. When I saw the trailer, I was like, I'll wait for the streamers, because I got 50 all of the streamers. I ain't going to the theater. People breathing on me to see no damn vampire movie. I love Ryan Coogler, but then I don't know what it was that made me like actually go get a ticket, sit in the theater, because I don't really do that. When did you know this was going to be special? Because I think a lot of us didn't know until we sat there. When did you know?
Oh, no, I knew when as soon as we started filming, because you know what? Ryan creates such a special atmosphere. The dude has an athletic background, and he's like a great coach. Everything is respectful, familial. I've never been on a more egalitarian set in my life. Mm. The young man knows everybody by name. It's 200 people on set. He knows every single person by name. And, you know, he produces with his wife. He has his lifelong friends that he produces his films with. His mama came to set. I was like, okay, this dude's on to something. And then when we started to shoot, and I would see the stuff that Autumn was doing, and he and I actually spoke about what the history, how he came up with the script. And we found out that we shared a bond because his family was from Mississippi and migrated to Northern California, whereas my family was from Mississippi and were sharecroppers and migrated to Southern California. And so we got on really well. And then about a quarter of the way through the production, one day we were at work and Mike came up to me. He was like, hey, man, you got to come to the monitor. My knees were screaming. My feet were screaming. I was like, man, I'm cool because I don't really like to watch myself while we're filming. He's like, no, come now. All right, man. So we go over there and we watch some footage. And Mike looked at me and he said, hey, I think we got one. I know Mike for like 20 years. We just never worked together. And it was around that time that I started to see the stuff that we were doing and how his vision was coming to life from the page to the screen to what we were filming. And I was like, oh, man, this is going to be something special. Then when he called me and he showed it to me, myself, Miles Caton that plays Preacher Boy, Jack O'Connell that plays Rennick, and Delroy Lindo, we all sat together and watched the film. And I mean, it's the first time that I've had a film that I'm in that lands on me as if I'm not in it, like I'm in the audience. The film is beautiful. You can't tell me nothing about this one. I mean, I absolutely love this film.
Besides the scene that everybody's talking about in the juke joint and the chain gang, which I heard that was complete ad lib by Delroy Lindo, like it wasn't scripted that way. What scene for you stood out like for the ages besides those two?
In all honesty, the Irish jig. The Rocky Road to Dublin scene is so key. It's such a key turning point in the story. And, you know, I heard you guys speaking before and you're spot on. All this stuff was well thought out. Ryan made sure that the vampire was Irish because the Irish people were enslaved like we were enslaved. So there's another dastardly level to the vampire that then in turn actually is luring other people through some sympathy and some empathy to the dark side. And you can go on for hours about that from a symbolic and from a metaphorical place. But we were out there that night. We had a hard time shooting this film because the juke is actually set on a bayou and there's a swamp. Alligators walked on set. There was chiggers in the ground. It was 100 degrees at night. Like this film was hard to make, really hard to make. And meanwhile, at that point, I'm there in the circle and the sun is about to come up. And we had to chase the sun to make sure that we got the shots. So Jack had to be on his game. You're watching Mike at this point playing Stack, and he's completely focused on the new joy that he has from his false passion and happiness of his eternal life that he's been given from the devil, if you will. And to see everybody at the top of their game, because we didn't have a lot of time. There wasn't a lot of takes. And to watch everybody at the top of their game and to see what that meant as a transition in the film, because they're connected through the music. You know, this is why Sammy is so appealing to him. It's his natural God-given talent, the music. And you can see Rimmick, the vampire, is totally and completely offended when we tell him he can't come in the juke because of his skin color. He can't believe that. He's devastated because he really does believe in the music. And he really does believe in the power of the music, you know. And it's really interesting because shortly after that, this is when he goes into a shot at colonization. There's so much in the film to cover. I mean, don't even get me started because we could do a symposium on all the different stuff in the films.
We yeah. should. We you should.
Know, speaking back to that piece, let me get this. I'm sorry to cut you off real quick. Speaking back about that piece about you guys, how you had the pastor on. You know, when I first read the script and he was basically doing the baptism of Sammy and he drops into lockstep with him on the Lord's Prayer. That's when I read the script and I was like, okay, I need to see where this is going to go because I might not be able to do this from a personal belief standpoint. And then one of the things that I think connects with people and makes them see the film multiple times is what he says when he goes into the Lord's Prayer. Remick says something so powerful. He said, these were the words forced upon me by the men who stole my land and killed my people. And I hated those men, but I still find comfort and truth in their words. So it is speaking deeply about religion, about colonization, about the word of God itself. It's well worth your time if anybody's on the fence. I think the biggest thing to know is that this is not a vampire movie. There's a movie with vampires in it, but this is not a vampire movie by any means.
Yeah, I agree. What's next, man? What you got cooking on next? Or are you tired of people asking that question already?
Oh, you never get tired of that. I mean, I'm of the mind that it's always better, never best. So I'm on to the next. I made a wonderful film in Italy that I'm waiting to find out when it comes out stateside because I would love people to see it. It's another actual period piece called Napoli to New York, and it did gangbusters numbers at the box office in Italy at the end of last year, but they've yet to release it yet stateside. And it, too, is a period piece that is strangely modern. And one of the things that Kugler did so expertly is we're in the 1930s, so the majority of the film was in the 1930s Mississippi, but the film is in lockstep with relevance for today, with everything that we're dealing with today. And when I say we, I don't even just mean we as the culture, we as black people. I mean Americans and the world.
Yeah, I mean, but
because
that's
we're in a very, very dark time.
That's how the spirit works and the ancestors work.
Amen.
I mean, when we're in alignment with it, it all becomes revelatory, and you do things today, not for today. Because you're throwing yourself into the future, but you're also there's so much going on. All right.
Experience Karen Hunter in a completely different way. Karen Hunter is awesome. The podcast.
If you like me on SiriusXM Urban View Channel 126, you're going to love me.
And Karen Hunter is awesome.
Hey, this is Karen Hunter, host of the Karen Hunter Show on SiriusXM's Urban View. Karen Hunter is Awesome is an actual podcast to bring heat and energy and knowledge and power. A 1-2 punch that I don't think you get anyplace else.
Tell the truth.
So check out the podcast wherever you get your podcast. You will not be disappointed.
All right, now let's hear from Native Land Podcasters.
What's up, everybody? It's been a minute, y'all. It's Andrew Gillum here, reintroducing myself through this mini pod. I hope everybody had a good weekend. If you're listening on Monday here live, and I know mine was eventful. That is for sure. So first point, a personal privilege. I want to wish again a very, very special and happy birthday to my life partner, my wife, my everything, my best friend, RJ Gillum, who turned blah, 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 yesterday, Sunday. And my son and the kids wrote their own cards out. I won't say her real age. I'll let her say it. But my oldest, Jackson, writes a beautiful note. And then at the end says, happy 57th birthday, mommy. And neither of those only one of those digits is in her age. It ain't the five. Okay, that's it. continuing. One more update. My kid, my youngest, Davis, breaks his damn arm in two places, and does it at school. And the most wildest thing, you know, I've seen. And what is great is the kid's threshold for pain is crazy good. Because shortly after I arrived to collect him and his siblings to go to the hospital, he starts comforting them. It's going to be okay, Caroline. It's going to be okay, Jackson. I thought, Davis, man, you are a soldier, because I'd be screaming bloody murder, which he was when we got there. But everybody's doing well. And I hope the same is true on your end. I am not going to take up a terribly long amount of time. I wanted to continue this conversation about resistance and organizing in the political environment that we all find ourselves, and really doubling down on this idea of doing it right where you are, in your own local community. And by the way, protests or opposition doesn't always have to come in the form of taking over a building or even lining the streets with people. A form of protest could be running for your local school board, your local city council, your county council, places and institutions locally who people often underestimate for their impact. But if you were to really analyze what probably impacts your everyday lived experience, the road you drive on, the power, you know, that you drive, you know, pull on for your electric supply, the schools that your kids attend, and quite frankly, the type of businesses that surround where you live and maybe where you go to church, the kind of infrastructure that either does exist or doesn't, say, for instance, internet or high-speed internet or fiber being available to you, and who are the people who provide that, and then who are the people who govern the rules that allow them to do what they do if the local government itself isn't the entity that does it. And whether you're organizing an effort for a cause, for people, or running for or supporting someone running for office, there's very, 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 very little you can do without resources. Those resources can come in the form of time, which a lot of times is exactly what you use the raised financial resources to do, pay somebody to provide a service to do a thing. And if you were able to have someone's time, and the right someone's time, they would be doing that work. And so by resources, I'm being a little bit elastic in that definition, but very specifically, now I wanted to just chat with y'all about what it means to do direct fundraising, to ask someone to support what it is you're doing or to support you directly. And I will not lie, fundraising was and has been for a long time like the bane of my existence when I had to do it pretty regularly. I really, really, really hated people. Calling folks to ask for money. And I think it has something to do with just maybe my childhood and how I grew up, very proud family, you know, maybe poor by objective standards, but, and my parents, you know, in their mind's eye, and they communicated the same to us, is that, you know, we were rich in love, we were rich in family, we were rich in spirit, and you know, I was just hoping we'd be rich in money, but whatever. They didn't raise us with a beggar's attitude, if you will. And I've associated asking people for things, money specifically, but even other things, as sort of breaking that cardinal rule that I think was instilled in me early. And so I had to walk myself back off the fact that it is not a burden that you're giving someone when you ask them to sow a seed into what you believe in or even into you directly. Say, for instance, you were a candidate and you needed to raise money, but rather it is a sign of respect and humility to be willing to go to someone and to respect them enough to say, I want you and I need you with me in order for this thing to be possible. People love to be asked. And that's exactly what a lot of candidates don't like to do the asking. And some people are in love with it. Y'all, you know, listen, you may be in love with it. You may like the idea and the challenge. I didn't. I would much prefer to call and check up and see how you're doing than call and ask for money. But to an extent, I got over it. I had to get over it. My race for governor, we raised, you know, over $60 million through various outlets and arms, wherein I had to make, you know, significant asks all along the way. In fact, in the primary process, and those of you around campaigns might be able to relate, I would go entire days, 7-8 hours of call time on the phone, calling folks. And some folks, you know, being willing to engage me in rather extended conversation. And to a person at the end of that day, every answer, and I'm not giving folks credit for their excuses, but for every question of around the money I wanted to raise, the answer was no from every single person to a person. And that was really challenging. And these were largely not people who I knew personally, or if I knew, didn't know very well personally, but these were people whose names were on a call list, a call sheet, that was provided to me, who had the characteristics through their previous giving of looking like I would be the type of person they might give to if asked. There was a lot in that by way of what I wanted to communicate, because a lot of folks are, I think, confused about how the process works around trying to raise money. One big, I think, you know, misnomer about it, and I think this is on the candidate side more than it is the organizational or the cause side of things, and that is that that people, how do you say, are sort of just sort of, that it's the scariest thing in the world that you could possibly do is to pick up the phone and call a person whom you don't know and ask them for money. But the truth is over time, a profile gets built on those individuals. If you have a finance staff person, they'll make you aware that, hey, John Doe looks like he gives to Sierra Club, and also a big supporter of criminal justice reform, because he gives to, you know, whatever democracy project that might be out there. You may not know them, but by reading a little bit about them and their interests kind of gives you a little bit of the courage necessary to pick up the phone and say, hey, John, you've been a, you know, a supporter of such and such and such, and my position on the environment it aligns with what I understand yours to be. And, you know, if you give me this amount, you know, we'll be able to do great things and build a beautiful future, prioritizing the things that both you and I care a great deal about. Those individuals are not unaccustomed to getting phone calls, to being asked for money. If you're nervous or a little bit uneasy about that process, please satisfy yourself by knowing that these people are used to this. And right now, at this stage, expect that if they're going to give money politically to this cause or to this individual candidate, that person or someone from that institution or that effort is going to reach out to them directly and ask them for money.
Good evening, Pittsburgh. It's just after 8 p.m. here in Pittsburgh, and you're tuned in to 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh. This is From the Basement from 8 to 9 p.m. Thanks for tuning in.
around. This is where we go, baby. Smiley Talk Talk, we absolutely mean it. Smiley Talk Talk is where we go, baby. Smiley Talk Talk, we absolutely mean it. Smiley Talk Talk, this is where we go, baby. Smiley Talk Talk, we absolutely mean it. Smiley Talk Talk, where we go, baby. Smiley Talk Talk, we absolutely mean it. Smiley Talk Talk.
My way.